Welcome back, everyone, to the Anti-Diet Club podcast. I am here with my co-host, Tamsin.
Hello. We're back together.
We're back together. We have just come off a recording with the absolutely fantastic Dr. Asher Larmy, who is our very first returning guest.
Yeah, it couldn't have been anyone else, though. It's just such a brilliant conversation.
It really was. We're both of us are kind of buzzing, aren't we?
Absolutely.
And it's quite late in the evening and we're hyped up. So for any of you listeners that have not heard of Dr. Asher Larmy, they are a transmasculine weight inclusive GP and leading expert in weight stigma. They're a fat activist and the founder of the No Way campaign, which is committed to putting an end to medical weight stigma. They have over 20 years of medical experience and have been fat for even longer than that, which is my favorite part of their bio. We also, neither of us, I don't think, have to hand what the number of episode Asher came onto previously, but we'll put it in the show notes, but have a wee scroll back and you can listen to the first episode that they were on. But this time round, we wanted to have them on to talk about weight loss injections, right?
Yeah, it's such a hot topic right now. And I went to their masterclass on weight loss injections and I just found it so fascinating. I immediately emailed them afterwards and said, please, please, please come back on the podcast. And I got an answer straight back saying, yes, yes, absolutely, could have come back on. But because I just think this is going to be something that we need to understand more about and need to understand what our clients and our listeners and anyone who kind of circles the anti-diet world is going to be facing in terms of conversations with doctors and conversations with family members, conversations with themselves, you know.
So it's all those conversations with us.
Yeah, exactly.
And especially here, I know a lot of our listeners are in the US, but here in the UK, these weight loss injections are being going to be prescribed and mandated by the NHS, which is our sort of universal healthcare system here. And that really makes this a much kind of more important and sort of heavier conversation, really, I guess, because this isn't something that people in the UK are going to be paying for out of pocket. This is going to be something that is, as I say, prescribed essentially free of charge as a solution to many sort of health conditions, but also just the pathologized condition of fatness, which is what we talk about here on the podcast all the time. So we, I learned so much. I don't know about you. I mean, you went to the masterclass, I didn't, but oh my gosh, like they absolutely, like they're just such a gold mine of information and has this ability to be able to read the research and be able to ask the critical questions that I certainly wouldn't be able to. And I'm pretty sure our listeners or clients likely wouldn't have that skill set either. So it really, really great to get their expertise on and sort of help us dive into how problematic this is.
Yeah, agreed. It's just something that they've just devoted the, you know, so much of their time to, and we're so grateful for them to bring that to us and our listeners. And yeah, I think we head over to the episode and you can hear it all there. Welcome back, Asher. It's so nice to have you with us. I instigated this episode today because I came to your recent weight loss injection webinar, I want to call it, which was really, really interesting. And after that call, I think I emailed you in about 3 seconds and said, will you come back on and talk about this, please? Because it was so interesting. And I think I spoke to Gillian about it and the reason, you know, we think it would be helpful for our listeners and also any clients that we are currently working with or working with in the future, you know, as coaches, helping people out of this anti-diet space and helping them into more body liberation space, we want to be able to have discussions around this because I think it's going to start coming up, if it hasn't already for Gillian, perhaps. It's going to start coming up in conversation. It's going to be one of those extra things that I think people are going to say, well, maybe I haven't tried it all. Maybe
that's right.
You know, so that's what, that was the reason. And I thought, I think it'd just be a really good time to talk about it, as it's a hot topic for you at the moment as well.
Thank you. You were so great, actually, because one of the things about, like, you know, webinars or masterclasses is you need a bit of feedback. And like the moment I saw that your name, because we had quite a lot of people I didn't recognize, I didn't see who was coming beforehand, but when I saw your name, I was like, oh, thank goodness, I've got like a friendly face, an ally. And you asked very good questions. It was really nice. So it's such a hot topic, isn't it? Because like you say, it's like this whole new, I don't know, genre, this whole new chapter. It's something new, and everyone is just like, well, this is different. This isn't like all the other stuff we've done. This is completely different. Where in actual fact, it is exactly the same. Mm-hmm. The only difference is it's packaged differently, you know.
Yeah.
Instead of as a diet, instead of as, you know, keto or Noom, whatever it is that we've been doing, people just think, well, this is completely different. It's a drug, it's a medication, it must be different.
And also, given that, I mean, we'll get into this, but given that it seems to be so mandated by the medical industry, the NHS, it sort of automatically comes with that feeling of, oh, well, it must be proven, it must be clinically proven, it must be safe, it must be effective, it must be the gold star if this is what's being promoted. So hopefully you're going to enlighten us a bit as to, firstly, anyway, if our listeners maybe haven't heard about what even this is that we're talking about, what is it that we're talking about? What is this new weight loss injection?
Right, so the injection itself, the medication's been around for a few years. It's used to treat diabetes. Ozempic is the one that is used quite often because it's a once weekly injection. So we've been using Ozempic for some time. Victoza is another one that was a daily injection. So people prefer obviously the weekly injection. But these are two diabetic drugs that we've had around not for very long, I must say. Probably people have been using them in the last 5 to 10 years more commonly. They're very expensive as diabetic drugs, which is why the NHS doesn't just give them out, but they are more and more now giving them out for diabetes. And then the manufacturer of these two drugs, Novo Nordisk, realized very quickly that the effect, one of the side effects really of this medication, is that it suppresses appetite, makes you feel full, makes you feel like you're not hungry. So they went, oh, there is a market for this. And I think that's something that we have to be very aware of. I'm actually writing a book about it. And I was looking at the research and actually looking at how they marketed it. And it was because they looked at the sort of space and went, there's nothing else out there. There is no weight loss drug that works. In fact, in the NHS, we don't really prescribe weight loss drugs at the moment, apart from this, because the only one that works is Orlistat. And for those who haven't tried Orlistat, that is a drug that basically you take and you poop out oil, and so your poop's kind of like yellowy orangey liquidy thing, and it's really quite disgusting, and nobody likes it for that. Sorry to be a bit
I wonder bad. Why
yeah but it's horrible. Yes, I mean, it literally, anyone who's tried it, I've tried it, so I know, Zenical, and if you've tried it, you know, you've been there, you've been like, you know what I'm talking about. So there's nothing good out there. So this drug manufacturer just went, great, like literally we can just take over the market, we can make a market, and they did.
And also presumably relatively quickly, because if you're saying this drug's been around for some time, is it already been sort of like passed all the sort of tests that it needs to come to market?
Absolutely not. That's a scary thing. So this drug has been around for a while for diabetics. And specifically, we know how it works in diabetics to control their blood glucose. So that's fine. Yeah. We don't really know about the very long-term side effects because it still hasn't been around that long. You know, a lot of drugs, you know, have to be around 15, 20 years before we can start to see whether there are any long-term impacts that we've missed. But when it comes to actually using this drug in a healthy, that's not a good word, in a non-diabetic, we've only got enough evidence since 2021. It's 2023. All right. So the study came out in 2021. The FDA passed licensed it the same year. The UK sort of held off for about a year. They sort of approved it, but went through the approval process. But then they gave it the actual stamp of approval, what, about 2 months ago? It was March this year.
Yeah.
We have zero evidence about the long-term impact of this medication. That is one of the terrifying things about this drug. But it is not surprising. Everybody sort of seems very surprised when I say this. That's because they have far too much faith in doctors, in the medical profession, in the NHS and the National Institute of Clinical Excellence. You seem to think that somehow they are above reproach. They're not. They are just as interested in they're just as much part of the pharmaceutical industrial complex as everyone else. So let's not give credit where credit's not due. They made a decision based on a whole bunch of lies that was sold to them by a drug company. And you've got to ask yourself, either they weren't trying to look, or they did look, they found and they ignored, which one of the two. We can't speculate.
But they come from a place of trying to make fat people thin people since forever, don't they? Yeah. So I think I just wanted to circle back to something you said just there and about the actual drug itself. When you were talking then about, you know, they noticed that the side effect was appetite suppression. Mm-hmm. But that kind of brings back around this kind of whole idea that our bodies are just a result of the calories in, calories out, which we know isn't true.
And this is what I tell everybody, look, it is very clear, every single study make this very clear, in the first year, if you starve yourself, and by that I mean you take in fewer calories than you need, you will start to lose weight. Your body is designed, we're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of years of evolution. Your body will handle it in the beginning. A little bit of weight loss, it doesn't panic. It gets to a certain stage and your body goes, it's been on for too long and it's too much weight and it starts to panic. So it slows right down. And if you look at every graph of anyone who has tried to lose weight in whatever way, shape or form, you'll notice a big loss in the first few weeks. Mm-hmm. Then it slows down. Then it hits the peak, which is called the nadir, and then it starts going up. And you see the exact same thing in this weight loss drug. It starts very quickly, then it peters off, and then you start regaining in about 10 months. The lie is being sold to us that if you stay on this drug, you will, you won't regain the weight. That's so the irony of the fact that the study showed that weight regain started at 10 months, and they just pretended it didn't. And then you look at the 2-year study. People gained 15% of the weight they'd lost back within 8 months. So 15% within 8 months. If you do the maths, within 5 years, they would have regained all the weight.
Yeah.
And that's what we know. We already know this. This is not news to us.
No, that model that you've just taken us through is exactly the same as most sort of weight loss journeys, exactly. Right? My question is then, is the intention then that you just keep taking this drug? Like, if it's prescribed by the NHS, like, how are they just going to prescribe it forever? What's the kind of lifetime of that?
And it's a very interesting thing, and I want to know what Novo Nordisk was planning, because they know that weight regain is happening. So in year two, weight regain is happening. I'm not talking about when you stop the drug. When you stop the drug, weight regain is phenomenal. It's at an unprecedented rate. So the moment you stop, it's not just that you regain the weight, it's that you regain the weight really quickly. And I have no problem with weight gain. I have a problem with weight loss followed by weight gain that quickly. That is harmful for your body. Your body is not designed to deal with these kinds of, you know, highs and lows.
Huge fluctuations.
Fluctuations are bad for your health. They mess with your insulin pathways to start with. They mess with, you know, your stress hormones, all of the things that we know are bad for your health. Mm-hmm. We know that this kind of weight fluctuation does. So what is interesting to me is that at the moment, as it stands, the NHS or NICE, the National Institute of Clinical Excellence, have said you can have this drug for 2 years. And Novo Nordisk agreed that even if you take the drug for 2 years and you stop taking it after another 3 years, your weight will have returned to what is considered normal within the population, which is basically you would have gained all the weight. So even they admitted that was the case. That's if you stop it after 2 years. So they're lying to people. They're saying, okay, fine. But hopefully by that point in time, you know, there'll be a maintenance dose. There's no such thing as a maintenance dose. Maintenance is not possible.
No.
You will regain even if you're on the full dose. So what will happen? I have some theories. Either they'll just turn around and say, it's not the drug, it's the patient. Or they'll turn around and say, you need to give them some stronger doses, which is the other thing.
That was going to be my question, right? Because am I right in saying you can also buy this drug over the counter?
No. So, yes and no. You can get, at the moment, Wegovy doesn't exist in the country. So they said they were going to have it on the shelves now, mm-hmm. and they've had to take that back. So I don't think we're actually going to get Wegovy for another year from what I've been reading.
Oh, okay.
Just because they've got a manufacturing issue, just because they've got a supply issue. They're yeah. selling so much of it in the US that mm-hmm. there just isn't enough.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that people are now prescribing Ozempic. Remember I said that was the diabetic drug?
Yeah.
It's a pen, like a little, it's a needle pen, right? And it's 1 milligram per week. Wegovy is 2.4 milligrams per week. So 1 milligram is a much lower dose and actually does not have the same impact when it comes to weight loss. If you look at the studies, mm-hmm. they've mm-hmm. compared the two and they know that it's not as effective,
mm-hmm.
but people are prescribing Ozempic off label. So that means that it's not licensed for weight loss, but people are mm-hmm. prescribing it anyway. That you can get here, not without a prescription, but you can pay for it privately. You can't in the UK at the moment pay for Wegovy because it's just not on the shelves unless yeah. you're bringing it in from another country. And I think that's
yeah. So two things that spring into mind when I hear you say this. One, does that mean that the diabetics who actually need it for their medical condition are
not getting it?
You know, yeah, there's a shortage.
100%.
And then secondly, if people are using it for weight loss purposes, they're going to need 2.5 times the quantity of somebody who's using it for diabetic purposes. Mm-hmm. And then I'm thinking, what happens when people, as you say, start receiving this message from, you know, the outside world? They internalize this idea that it's their problem, it's not the drug, they're failing somehow, right? Or they take it as prescribed and inevitably they gain the weight. And I know from my dieting days, what then happens is there's the guilt and the shame, but then there's the doubling down. Mm-hmm. And when you think of what the doubling down is in diet terms, it's even more restriction. It's even more sort of compulsive exercise. It's more extreme measures. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking, if you can buy this drug, does that mean that people are just going to be upping the quantity in their own, you know, like their own prescription of it, yeah. basically?
It's going to become a drug of abuse, there's no doubt.
Yeah.
And, yeah. you know, when I sat down to write this book that I'm writing, the thing that struck me was that I'm very aware of there's a drug called OxyContin, not as much of a big deal in the UK because it was never legalized in the UK, but Oxy is the reason that the US has this massive opioid crisis. An opioid crisis, again, that doesn't really exist in other parts of the world. It is an America problem. And that is because a drug in the late 90s, early 2000s was marketed for moderate to severe pain. And it was an opioid that was very addictive. And as a result, we have, you know, they have problems now with not just Oxy, but with heroin, with fentanyl. It's terrible what's going on there. But if you actually look at the marketing strategy of this company, Purdue, one family, the Sacklers, if you look at the marketing strategy, you can see what they did in order to achieve, literally, I think it was within 3-4 years, 23 times as much. As much money they made 20 they
wow.
they didn't double their profit. How do you explain that? You know, 23 times the profit.
Times the profit, yeah,
it's insanity. I mean, how they wow. managed to achieve it. But knowing that the drug was not suitable for mm-hmm. this condition, and in fact their drug wasn't anything special. OxyContin's not special, it's just a regular old opioid. The fact that it wasn't even that great, and B, was causing massive problems and was being misused and abused. People were crushing it, snorting it. They managed to keep upselling it for over a decade before people started getting involved. And I just think that this is what Novo is going to do. They are going to wash their hands of it eventually and say, well, it wasn't our fault. We, you know, people used it, they abused it. They will blame the individual. They will always yeah. blame the individual.
Yeah.
In so many different ways. But absolutely, it will be a drug of abuse.
Despite the fact that the medical industry have been not solely responsible, but they've played a really big part in the weight stigma that people are faced with, right? The reasons why people will go to such extremes, because they're denied surgery, they're denied access to services, they're discriminated mm-hmm. against in all kinds of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And then to wash your hands and say it's not our fault, but mm-hmm. it's like, well, A, you brought the drug to market, and you secondly did. you have played a part in creating this culture where bigger bodies aren't, fat bodies aren't accepted, right? Yeah. So there is a responsibility there. And yeah, I can see it just being turned back on the individual, as you say.
I would actually argue that those two things are one and the same. They created a market, mm-hmm. and to create the market, they stigmatize bodies. So let me give you an example of this. You will have heard of a condition called prediabetes, right? Mm-hmm. The technical term is impaired fasting glucose or impaired glucose tolerance, but nobody uses those terms because they sound very fancy and no one understands what they mean. In 2001, the American Diabetic Association wanted to change the name, make it more catchy. It's a PR stunt. How do we make people take this more seriously? So they coined the term pre-diabetes. And experts around the world said, oh, hang on a second, what makes you think this is pre-anything? Just because you've got slightly high sugar doesn't mean that you're going to develop diabetes. And in fact, since then, all the studies have shown that very few people with impaired glucose tolerance or impaired fasting glucose actually do develop diabetes. Mm. And most of the people that develop type 2 diabetes don't go through the pre-stage, right? They go from regular to diabetes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they created this phenomenon, a condition that doesn't exist, that all of the experts around the world said didn't exist. It was one organization funded by guess who? Novo Nordisk, mm-hmm. Eli Lilly, and all the other drug companies that are involved in this drug right now. And the Center for Disease Control, the CDC in the US, which is kind mm-hmm. of like our NICE, right? They mm-hmm. went along with it, but the rest of the world didn't. And so we've adopted this kind of half adopted pre-diabetes. We use it a lot in language. The language mm-hmm. is really upsetting. But what does pre-diabetes mean to most people? It means fat, because what's the only thing we tell people? The only thing is you're pre-diabetic, you need to lose some weight.
Yeah, it's only fat people that get that. Fat. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we have created in the last 20 years a culture in which fatness is associated with disease, which has always existed to a degree, but not like it does now. Mm-hmm. And that, I believe, is the diabetes industry or the anti-diabetes industry or whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. has played a role in that. And that's why, the NHS combines diabetes and quote unquote obesity together. They lump them together as one thing. We have become associated with a condition that it's completely and utterly unfair. But that's where your mind goes. That's why mm-hmm. when people want to be mean to me on Twitter, they're like, good luck with your diabetes, because that's the insult, right?
Yeah.
Because they think thin people don't get it.
Yeah.
You know, I always use my husband as an example, because he's type 2 diabetic. And if anybody ever, he talks about it, people go, you don't look diabetic, but you're straight, you're slim, you're straight sized. You know, what does that mean? You know, he's just like, it's just.
And he's like, hereditary. Quote unquote, fit and healthy, because, his job, he's very active. Yeah. And
It's assumed. So when he went to the doctor and his diagnosis came around, mm-hmm. they went, oh yeah, it's hereditary, because they had nothing else to throw at him,
right?
Because anyone else, it's completely different conversation.
And I always say to people, look, you gain weight in diabetes, or insulin resistance, which is the precursor to diabetes, mm-hmm. makes you gain weight. Insulin, when it's floating around in your body, makes you turn sugar into fat. It's a process called lipogenesis, right? And it increases the amount of fat in your blood. And in doing so, it increases the amount of fat cells, or the size of the fat cells in your body. Mm-hmm. When the first stage of insulin resistance is to have high levels of insulin in your blood. That's how we measure it. We measure your insulin levels. So insulin resistance, the process of insulin resistance, which is almost certainly genetic. We know this. We've seen, mm-hmm. we've got twin studies that basically prove this. Insulin resistance makes you gain weight. The reason most people are fat when they are diagnosed as diabetic is because they've gained weight over their lifetime because they're insulin resistant. Mm-hmm. So somebody like myself, I had gestational diabetes quite early on in my pregnancies. It was very clear that I was insulin resistant. I didn't develop diabetes for almost 10 years, actually. But COVID set it off. I got an infection, and all of a sudden, boom, I was diabetic, and that happens very often. But what I keep saying is that it's not weird that I'm fat. It'd be weird if I wasn't fat. In fact, the thin diabetics, you're like, oh, that's really interesting. Something's happening there that isn't happening in most people, and I wonder what that is. So your husband is the you know, he's the odd one out. He's the one that didn't gain weight.
Yeah.
And we got to wonder why. And we got to wonder, this gene that causes us to gain weight, you know, a lot of people say it's our survival gene. It's how we as a species survive.
Yeah,
that's really interesting.
And it makes me think, right, these conditions that are associated with insulin resistance, so like diabetes, PCOS, endometriosis, mm-hmm. these kinds of conditions, right, if weight gain is essentially a very, very common side effect of these conditions, and then what is essentially being treated is the fatness, mm-hmm. The side effect is being treated.
Yeah.
It makes you think, like, nature is designed that in a way, right? It's we probably don't know, you can tell us, I'm sure, if we even know if it's something that is protective or helpful for us. We probably don't know, but you're trying to sort of eradicate that part that nature's kind of almost doing for us that we might not understand, mm-hmm. as opposed to, and Tamsin and I were saying this earlier, the actual thing, the condition that the person's dealing with, the PCOS or the endometriosis or whatever it is, might fly under the radar, mm-hmm. if the medical profession is so fixated on, well, you're fat, so mm-hmm. here's some injections to make you thin, mm-hmm. but you're not actually then understanding what the condition is,
which that's is right. already happening, right? That's right. That's, you know, that's already happening. But I think what we were talking about just before was that this is going to get worse because of this weight loss drug, because there's now a cure,
in quotes.
And
PCOS is a really good example, actually, because PCOS is a condition that only really affects people assigned female at birth, people with ovaries, and people with ovaries generally are far less researched within the medical profession, right? Like, ovaries are not very important. They never have been. Nobody really cares about periods. There's no real evidence. A lot of gynecology and the, you know, although I would argue that PCOS is actually an endocrinologist issue. It's a metabolic condition. It is not a gynecological condition, but gynecologists still treat it. And they don't know what they're talking about. Like, literally, I'll have a conversation with them, and after, like, you know, 2 seconds, I'm like, okay, well, we're done, because we're coming from very different places. But this is a really classic example where you have insulin resistance, and the reason they call this a thrifty gene, this genetic propensity to sort of hold on to our weight, to basically hold on to our weight, absolutely has resulted from, as I said, thousands, tens of thousands of years of evolution. Society changed very dramatically in the last 200 years. Mm-hmm. Evolution has to catch up, and it will take another 10, 20, 30,000 years for evolution to catch up. Once upon a time, we lived in a world where food was scarce. We don't live in that world for the most part anymore. And I mean, I'm talking about in the UK, and I'm talking about people who aren't under the poverty line, because actually food is scarce for some people. Mm-hmm. But in general now, most people have access to food. So evolution hasn't caught up yet. As far as evolution is concerned, our body will hold on to the weight no matter what. Mm-hmm. The more you try mm-hmm. to stop that process, the more it's going to hold on to that weight, which is why mm-hmm. up to 2/3 of people who go on a diet will end up gaining more weight than when they started. Your body's like, I'm holding on, mm-hmm. and we'll continue to do so. That's how we survived as a species. If we lost weight and kept losing weight and didn't try and keep hold of it, we would have mm-hmm. died out
a long time ago,
right? So this is a very natural, normal physiological process. It is not, I do not consider this to be a pathological process. This is physiology. This is our mm-hmm. bodies doing what our bodies are designed to do. It's something like insulin and something like PCOS, where there is an absolute link to insulin resistance, but we haven't been bothered to look at why the two are linked. Mm-hmm. How does PCOS come about? What causes it? We've not done the research. We don't know. I've tried desperately to find the answers to this question. They don't exist. So mm-hmm. what do? We look at the fact that, oh, lots of people with PCOS are fat. So like you say, we'll just treat the fatness, because that's A, simple, and B, there's a lot of money in that. People mm-hmm. are making money out of treating fatness.
Yeah.
It's not just diet companies now. It's also bariatric surgeons that are making a lot of money and are also very heavily involved with the guidelines committees, when it talks, like, for example, you're making some guidelines about PCOS, the metabolic surgeons are absolutely involved in that process, as are companies like Novo Nordisk. They've always been involved in these processes. They've always been spending money and lobbying organizations and lobbying the parliament. And they spend a lot of money on parliament as well. You know, they have always been pushing the let's treat the fatness route, because there's money to be made in let's treat the fatness. Whereas, you know, some, like, you know, endocrinologists somewhere might be like, well, maybe we should try and figure out what causes PCOS. And everyone's like, who wants to do that? That's how it works in medicine. We are fighting organizations. Like, the weight loss industry is worth $75 billion a year. Like, we talk about this, right? Yeah. Worldwide. We're fighting a $75 billion a year company or industry in general. How do you fight that when there's just one or two doctors thinking, maybe we should do a little bit more digging? That's the issue. What more can I say? That's the problem we're facing.
While we're talking about profits, though, I want to talk about that, because we were talking about that before as well, about, you know, obviously we're talking about the usual diet industry that we're all usually talking about in slimming clubs. And that's what, you know, doctors are actually prescribing that, you know, it's kind of been the norm. And let's take, you know, Slimming World, Weight Watchers, all of that, which has been typically what they've been prescribing. Mm. And I'm thinking, you know, wonder what they're thinking about this kind of new route that we're taking and how that landscape looks, because that £15.5 million that Slimming World was worth back in 2017, which is quite a long time ago now, you know, goodness knows what that looks like now.
Yeah.
And I wonder what I'm interested in the politics around that and the kind of stuff. And I'm not suggesting that necessarily you know the answer to that,
but I do
excited.
Interestingly enough, I know Slimming World hasn't done anything yet, but Weight Watchers I know has. Weight Watchers is, because Slimming World is predominantly UK based, right, whereas Weight Watchers is an international organization. So my nemesis, I have a nemesis, I have a few, but one of them is a doctor called Dr. Nadolski. He's very popular on the old Instagram, and everyone loves him. He's some people find him attractive. I don't, but that's a personal thing. But, you know, he's sort of muscular. He looks very fit, and he's a doctor, and he sometimes has a lab coat on and sometimes has
He got a picture with his, like, stethoscope around his neck?
He's exactly got that picture with his stethoscope around his neck. You bet he has.
I see those pictures, I think you're not a doctor.
Yeah. So he is a real doctor, but interestingly, he's the same kind of doctor as me. So he's a family practitioner.
Where's your photo with your white coat and your stethoscope?
I've never had a white coat since medical school, and I used that white coat when I was doing dissections. So basically, it smelled of like formaldehyde and dead body. So there was no chance.
Want you to take that picture as just like a kind of market. Would make my day.
I'll have to sort of find one, and I managed to break my stethoscope the other day as well. I've had this since medical school. It's 20 years old, and I broke it. And I was like, no.
And there's all these other people swinging it around their neck and having fun.
Yeah, don't need to use it, Asha. You just need to drape it around your neck. Like, it gives you doctor status.
That's probably why I haven't done one, because I really can't stand the doctor status. But anyway, my nemesis, Dr. Nadolski, he does not like me, and it always blocks me because I'm always telling the truth and speaking to the fact that he is not to be trusted, because he's very much involved with these weight loss drugs, because he's a huge fan and a huge sort of, you know, he's constantly reassuring everybody. The last time we got into it, he was reassuring everybody that it was safe to give these drugs to children, because obviously the American Academy of Pediatrics have brought out these guidelines saying children as young as 12. Novo is pushing for children as young as 8. So I was furious, because I'd read the study and I was like, this is absolute nonsense. You can't do this. It's dangerous. And he was sort of very, in that kind of, mansplaining-y kind of way, sort of like, folks, calm down. I'm not going to do the accent, but let's relax. You've got to trust the doctors. And I lost it. And I was like, you are a shill. No one should trust you. And of course I got blocked. But what was so fascinating was, like, 3 weeks later, and this is, there is a point to this story. I read an article saying that Weight Watchers had bought a company. And I forget what the name of the company is now. Anyway, in America, it's a telehealth company that basically, their only job is to sell these weight loss drugs. So you, you can phone up, have a consultation over the phone, and then you get a prescription and you can get the weight loss drug. So Weight Watchers bought it for $130 million. That's your $15 million to shame, doesn't it, Slimming World? $130 million Weight Watchers bought it.
Oh my gosh.
Because they saw that they were going to be taken over. And
the market is shape-shifting and they need to go with it.
So let's
That's so interesting though, isn't it? Because they've just gone where the money is. They're paid that amount of money. Imagine what they think it's worth.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But
you know,
who do you think runs the company? That's the thing that really annoys me. Guess who owns the company?
God.
Dr. N, it's his company. Dr. Nadolski.
Is
company, $130 million. And I kept saying to him, you're in cahoots. Absolutely not. I refuse to accept that. And when I saw that, I was
no way.
Oh my God.
But I mean, he's got to get away with it. He's still got 200,000 followers on Instagram. It doesn't matter. People like that will always get away with it.
Yeah.
It's his company, $130 million. That's why I keep telling people, stop trusting doctors. They are not to be trusted.
We're especially though, aren't we, that is a conditioning I feel that is just we've gotta I think I've even said it myself to my kids, you know, we've got to do what they say, because that's how you kind of get them to take the medicine you want them to take. That's how we, you know, get we were talking about COVID vaccines
just before we came on the recording here. I was like, you know, there is this inherent trust comes with the NHS and doctors, especially in the UK. I think maybe, I don't know, maybe there's more skepticism in the US because I know they've had more sort of experience with drugs coming to market too quickly and there being some really hideous side effects. But in this country, I feel like we have this blind trust of the NHS. And, you know, during COVID was a really interesting time because there was a lot of talk about, you know, these COVID vaccines, and they've come around really quickly, and have they been tested and are they proven? And, you know, I remember just thinking, well, I've no idea, but I'm scared. Yeah. And I'm putting my faith in the people that apparently know best.
Right.
And when I said that, you said, Tamsin, yeah, but it's the same with weight, because we've created the same way that I and many others was scared of COVID and dying of COVID. We're told the same thing, that if you're fat, you will die of fatness. If you want to live a long life and see your children grow up, then you can't be fat. So there is that same fear mongering of
point, isn't it?
Like, your back's against the wall. I'm being told I'm gonna die early. I'm gonna get sick, so therefore I will go to these desperate measures and not necessarily ask the right questions.
And so I always say to people, look, you shouldn't inherently trust your doctors. And you know, I've gotten into a lot of trouble with this. I mean, it's not really possible for me to practice medicine anymore as a result of this, because my colleagues want nothing to do with me. They do not like me. They don't believe what I have to say. And they're trying very hard to ruin my career. Fine. That's a personal issue. But when I say you can't trust doctors, what I mean is you can't blindly trust doctors. When a doctor, any doctor is ever, I mean, one of the first things we're taught in medical school, when you are recommending a medication, an injection, you know, whatever it is, you need to get informed consent. It's all about informed consent. And it's not just consent, it's informed consent. What does that mean? It means we have to tell you the pros and the cons, right? The risks and the benefits. We need to tell you about the side effects. We need to tell you about the long-term impacts. And we need to tell you about your other options, including the option of doing nothing. That's informed consent. So whenever a doctor says anything to you, like, for example, I want to give you this antibiotic for your sore throat. Theoretically speaking, now, of course, sometimes it's obvious, but, you know, you should be saying, look, the benefit of this antibiotic is that it's going to cure the bacterial infection that's causing this problem in your throat, and you'll get better quicker. And if you leave it, you probably will take much longer to get better, and maybe possibly you will develop a bacterial infection that spreads into your blood, and then you'll have sepsis, and then potentially you could die. And so we should be telling you all the information, and then giving you a chance to just say, okay, I will choose this. And we shouldn't be coercing or pressuring you. Okay, I choose to take this drug because you've informed me and I'm making the decision. It should have been the same with the COVID vaccine. It was desperate times, right? Desperate times, desperate measures. What we should have been saying to people from the start is, look, we know COVID is killing people. We do not know enough about this drug, this this infection, and we won't know about it for another 10, 15, 20 years. This vaccine has been shown to be effective, but we've only had it for a few months and we don't know if there's going to be long-term side effects. But you have a choice here. You can either risk it or you can take the vaccine and hope for the best. And that was what we should have been saying to people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I felt very comfortable recommending to all of my patients that they should take the vaccine, because I felt very comfortable saying, look, the alternative is that you get sick from this infection. And we do know that people who aren't vaccinated are dropping like flies. And I've mm-hmm. seen it happen with my own patients. And is that what you, do you want to take that risk? Mm-hmm. And for most people, especially with vaccinations, they don't want to take the risk. I mean, it's the yeah. same with measles. You don't want measles. Trust me. Mm-hmm. People died of measles all the time just because they don't anymore. So that's vaccines. The problem with fatness is when you say to people, all right, now do the informed consent thing with fatness. Mm-hmm. Is there any evidence that weight loss works? No, actually, all the evidence suggests otherwise. It's not sustainable. Is there any evidence that weight loss improves your health? No, not in the long term, actually. If you go beyond 1 year, even 2 years, there's no evidence that it benefits any. You name a condition, I'll prove to you that it doesn't. Is there any evidence that this can cause harm? What are the risks? At which point I will tell you the risks of weight loss are really significant. The more extreme you do the measures you take, mm-hmm. so like severely calorie restricting or using drugs or
surgery,
the more extreme you go, the more risks you have. Mm-hmm. And even the risks of just an eating disorder or disordered eating or an eating disorder, that is enough to really terrify you, because mm-hmm. that will kill you. You know, that mm-hmm. that's a real, like, we know the statistics there. We know how, and especially people in larger bodies, because they often go undiagnosed, they often go undertreated, et cetera, et cetera. So there's the risk of eating disorders. There's the risk of weight fluctuations, which we said, again, weight fluctuations are really, really bad for your health. And there's just the risk of weight stigma itself, in that people are sick and tired of getting that Weight Watchers referral. So they mm-hmm. stop going to see their doctor. All of these things have been shown to be harmful. And we know that these risks exist. Are there any benefits? Not that we know of. Are there any risks? Absolutely. Are there any long-term implications? Yes. We've shown that in people who, you know, over 10, 20 years, people who fluctuate in their weight have higher mortality rates, much more likely to have a stroke, much more likely to have a heart attack. So we know the long-term implications are bad. So mm-hmm. then if you present that information to people, which is just honest to God, evidence-based information, and say, now you choose, what are your other options? Well, you could do nothing, or you could try this, or you could try this, or you could try this, but don't try weight loss. You present all of those options. Most sensible people will say, I'm not doing the weight loss thing. Because yeah. that doesn't sound particularly appealing.
Yeah.
It's not like with COVID, when we were like, well, your other option is to not take it and possibly die. Most mm-hmm. people are like, do you know what? Take it. But that's the opposite of weight mm-hmm. loss. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it just angers me when I say you shouldn't trust your doctor. What I mean is, don't trust a doctor that just tells you what to do. The doctor should be presenting you with the evidence, and it has to be accurate evidence. If a doctor is saying, this is going to cure your condition, this is going to put your diabetes into remission, this is going to prevent you from having a heart attack, they're lying, because mm-hmm. I have got the evidence to prove otherwise. And that's the very frustrating thing here is that, A, we're not doing our jobs, we're not doing the informed consent thing, and even when we are, we are basing that informed consent on misinformation, lies, and myths that have been sold to us by the weight loss industry, as opposed to actual hardcore real evidence.
Yeah. I mean, not only is this hardcore evidence being withheld, but just before we came onto this recording, I really, really just quickly Googled weight loss injection. Mm. And the first few things that came up on the Google page was lose up to 15% body weight, clinically proven, live longer and healthier, which how can anyone claim that, right? And then it says that the NICE guidelines state it as being safe, effective, and cheap.
It's frightening, though, isn't it?
Sorry, it's the cheap meat that really got me. I was like, really? It's very expensive.
Yeah.
So, and this is another thing that we were talking about in terms of, you know, like, this again feels like it's got an edge of privilege attached to it yet again. Mm. Because although we're not suggesting that we want it to be affordable for people because we don't agree with it, but it feels like, again, here we are going, oh, well, you can have this nice thing, but, you know, and it will cure everything, but
during a cost of living crisis, £150 for however many injections when people are struggling to put food on the table. It's but people are actually would actually sacrifice a lot to find that money, right?
Absolutely, and that's, I mean, it's phenomenal. A, that they're lying. I mean, because these are flat out lies. First of all, that none of the studies have ever looked at measures of health. They've never looked at measures of health. They took the raw data and they never analyzed it. And I've always wondered, why didn't they analyze it? Because you've got the raw data. And my suspicion is they didn't analyze it because they knew that the raw data didn't show anything positive. And if you're not going to show anything positive, maybe just leave it alone. They've only ever measured weight loss. The up to 15% I agree with, but they had to specify that that was only the case because these people were also on a 500 calorie diet. They were also exercising.
What? If I'm taking an injection, I don't want to be dieting. I thought that was the whole point.
No.
That you would inject so that you don't have to diet.
No, these people were all on a 150 minutes of exercise a week, which is fine. They were having a monthly calls with a weight management specialist, personal phone calls, and they were on a 500 calorie for a year, for a whole year whilst taking these injections. It wasn't just take the injection. Oh, that'd be easy. No. And so all of this, you know, so you have to, it's up to 15%, but then read the small print as long as you're on a diet. What was the other things they said? It is not cheap. It's one of the most expensive drugs out there, actually. And even in terms of treating diabetes, it's twice as expensive as the second most expensive diabetic drug. It's something like, I don't know, 200 times as expensive as metformin. It's very expensive. And the other thing we have to understand about NICE, which is slightly different to the FDA and other countries, is that when NICE is making a decision about drugs, they're also responsible for the NHS. So they have to decide whether or not it's cost effective as well as clinically effective, right?
Okay.
So the FDA doesn't have to worry about that because the FDA is not paying for the drug, but we, the NHS, is paying for the drug. So they had, in order to persuade NICE in the first place that to give them the go ahead, they had to show that it was going to benefit people's health. Otherwise, why would NICE pay for it?
Mm-hmm.
And if you look, it's a 500 page document. You really got to be determined to read this document. I am one of these crazy people.
God love you.
Wants to read it. I mean,
I
skimmed a lot of it. So I was like, yeah. But the interesting thing is that calculation was absolute nonsense because they had to prove that weight loss somehow, you know, would benefit people's health, especially only 2 years worth of weight loss, because that's all they were getting. And the calculation was a lie. And even it was even implied that your calculation is wrong. But yet, I mean, I want to know who was in the room when they made that decision, when they looked at that calculation and knew that it was the biggest pile of you know what, and just approved it anyway. I want to know how many, you know, palms were greased in order to make that decision.
Yeah.
It's the most unethical, and the only people in that room were Novo Nordisk and people that Novo Nordisk had paid. So the only people on that committee was the guidance committee. All of their experts were all paid by Novo Nordisk.
So and all the studies were paid by them as well, right? Which is the first, I mean, I'm not any kind of researcher or medical person, but the first thing I know to do is when people talk about studies or research, you ask who funded it, right? Like, do they have a stake in the game?
They paid, not only did they fund it, they also paid someone to edit it and also paid someone to make it more presentable. So they actually wrote the presentation. They didn't find the raw data, but they wrote the actual study. So they are so unethical, and they just, it's so flawed. Regan Chastain talks about this a lot, about weight science, and you know, she's absolutely the expert, and I sort of learn so much from her. But the way she describes how unethical the whole field of medicine, of weight loss medicine is, mm-hmm. it's terrible. And, you know, we mentioned briefly bariatric surgery. Folks, bariatric surgery is the most extreme form of weight loss. And people assume that once you do it, you've lost weight and that's it. That's not
That's not the case.
You regain weight, vast majority. Oh, and you know, that diabetes they promised it would cure. Yeah. You're only going to go into remission for a few years and then you're going to come back out of it. Imagine pinning everything you have on bariatric surgery.
Yeah.
And what was fascinating about the weight loss drugs is they're being seen as, you know, in many sort of parts of the community, they're being sold as the, like, if bariatric surgery didn't work, try this injection, it will.
Oh, which is such
a lie. Yeah. And it's just, like you said, the doubling down.
They know
the doubling down because they're tapping into that fear, that shame.
Yeah. But twice the shame, right? It's mm-hmm. like, if you, I was saying to Tamsin earlier, I don't know if you follow the work of, is it Bree Campos, I think her name is, on Instagram. And she talks a lot about how she had weight loss surgery mm-hmm. and put the weight back on, and but it's the guilt and the shame that you live with, the embarrassment that people know that you've mutilated your body and still, so, you know, the weight came back on. It's there's so much more stigma attached to it, and I just feel for anybody that believes that there's not going to be a cost attached to it. And even right, we're talking about, even if, okay, you put the weight back on, even if it doesn't cure your condition, you're dealing with the stigma to it again. But also, with all of that, what Tamsin and I talk about on this podcast all the time is, even if the cost is just, quote unquote, just, you end up with a disordered relationship with food, the cost of that is huge, because all of these things, the surgery, the injections, they all the injections suppress your appetite, right? Again, like what we were saying about trying to cure a side effect of fatness rather than the condition, it's you're impairing this really, really natural process in your body of hunger signals and satiety mm-hmm. signals, mm-hmm. and you're screwing with that, and that's really hard to recover from. It's costly.
Look, I hate to say this, but we only have a certain amount of time on this earth, right? An average of 80 years or so. We're not going to live forever. None of us are. And there is actually very little we can do to change how long we're going to live. Most of it, almost all of it, is determined by where we're born, who we're born to, and our experiences in early life, our genetics, and also just, you know, pure chance and luck. If you know you're only going to live a certain amount of time on this planet, you've got to ask yourself, how do I want to live? What do I mm-hmm. want for my life? I spent 40 years trapped in diet culture. Most of us have had to sort of recover from diet culture, right? Mm-hmm. And what I realized quite early on was, I want to spend the rest of my life like this. I want to enjoy it, even if it's going to take years off my life, which I don't believe it will. But even if it did, I want to live and be happy, right? I want to enjoy my life. I want to be able to go to that restaurant and eat. I want to be able to eat that piece of cake without feeling guilty. Because actually, it's not the cake. It's the guilt. It's the emotions that I experience on a daily basis, the shame, feeling like I failed, feeling like I'm not worthy and all of this stuff. And we're talking here about moving from sort of out of diet culture but into fat liberation. For me, the key has been embracing the fact that I am fat. Nothing can change that. And yes, I'm facing hardships, and yes, that's something to be upset about. It's something that we need to work on. It's something that we need to fight against, all of those things. But actually, for the most part, I try to focus on all of the positive things, which is like, I'm happy, and I've been happy for the first time for the last couple of years. I'm experiencing a kind of joy I have never experienced before. Mm-hmm. And it's worth it for me. It is. Yeah. All of these, you know, these injections would destroy me if I took them. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just not prepared to do that. I'm not prepared to live with the nausea that 65% of people have when they have it. I'm not prepared to live with the abdominal pain. You know, this slow your gastric emptying, which means that you're constantly feeling nauseous and wanting to vomit. I don't want that. Headaches, dizziness, even that, forget everything else. That I'm like, no, That's not for me. Right. I'm not spending my days feeling like that anymore. And also, I don't want to suppress my appetite. Eating is actually a very joyous thing, and it can be. And I've just started to learn how to listen to my body when it tells me I'm hungry. Today, I was eating halfway through the meal. My meal, I was like, I really feel full. I don't even know why. This is a normal portion size to me, but I feel full. So I'm just going to stop eating. But this has become natural to me. I didn't understand that concept until a couple of years ago. So people, you know, as a doctor, I'm telling you, it's okay to be fat. As a doctor, I'm telling you, weight loss is just not going to fix anything. It's just going to make things worse. But as a human being, I'm telling you, you deserve to be happy. And I know that you've been told, if you're fat, you've been told all your life that you don't deserve to be happy. But that is not true. You absolutely deserve to be happy. You deserve to enjoy food. You deserve to be able to go out and eat whatever you want without judgment. And I know it's hard, and I'm not trying to belittle your experience, but this is what you are entitled to. This is what you deserve. There is nothing wrong with you. There's nothing inherently wrong with you. Your body is just doing what your body was meant to do. For some people, it's to, you know, develop type 2 diabetes and still be slim. That's weird to me, but, you know, it happens. But for most people, it's to be fat and diabetic. It's to be fat and have PCOS. It's to be, or just to be fat. You don't even have to have a reason. Just fat, you know, just because you are.
Just evolutionary fat.
I love that you've, you know, we're sort of coming to the end of the podcast on a really strong message of fat joy. I just love that. I think we get so into the conversations about all the things that are wrong, and actually you've done what we kept saying we need to start doing a little bit more of on the podcast, which is really, really emphasize the joy.
Because you're right, we get so bogged down in addressing people's fears, right, because they're really legitimate and they've been so internalized by all these messages. But on the other side of it, there is a real joy and pleasure in the freedom and the liberation that this work can bring. And thanks for mentioning that, and thanks for coming back on. And I want to, before we wrap up, I really want you to, because I know last time we had you on the podcast, we were thinking it might even be almost a year ago now.
I think so,
something like that. And I know that things have changed for you in terms of how you're helping folks, and I believe you're running a course right now. And I really, you know, there's going to be people listening here going, I actually need to hear more from Asha. I need to be around this more. So how can you help? How can you help them?
Oh, that's amazing. Thank you. I feel like basically, as I said, my career in medicine had, took a nosedive, and I knew it would. And that was fine, because I was still like, I actually want to do this work. So I've got a lot more time. And as a result, I'm running like these little, I call them masterclasses, because I want people to become masters in these conditions so that they know more than their doctors. And so that when their doctor says something, they can be like, no, I actually know what the evidence shows. So I did the weight loss injections. I've done insulin resistance and diabetes. I'm doing one about menstruation, where I'm covering things like PCOS and endometriosis and menopause. I'm doing a joint pain one. I'm doing weight loss surgery. That's the one that I'm doing this week. Actually, I don't know when this comes out, but, you know, I'm doing weight loss surgery. So every week I'm just basically running a 1-hour masterclass, which you can just hop on and you can come. I spend about half an hour talking about, you know, doing a presentation, some slides, you know, and then we do about half an hour of question and answers. And it's usually a really good experience, and people can, you know, chat and give each other ideas as well. And it's always a lovely thing. But there is deep down inside of me, there's been this burning desire for a long time to help people to navigate the consultation in a much more kind of like, not just, oh, I'll throw a bit of information at you. You know, that's all well and good, but that's not enough. Believe it or not, I try to figure out how to do this. And it came down to a six-week course teaching people how to navigate a consultation with a doctor in a fat body. And I just, you know, the fact that I'm running this course horrifies me, because there should be no such thing. This course should not exist. Mm-hmm. And it disgusts me that it does. But it's also a real need for the people in the community. So I spend 6 weeks. The first 2 weeks, we don't even hit the consultation room. We haven't even entered the consultation in the first 2 weeks. We're preparing for the consultation. Mm-hmm. That's how big of an issue this is for people. Mm-hmm. And I know almost anyone who's fat is terrified of the doctor. I know very few people that are like, yay, doctors, I love going to see them. No, we're all terrified. So I run this course to basically help people to navigate these really difficult issues, or, you know, and just preparing, communicating, you know, and we cover everything for, like, you know, all the way up until you can't have this procedure for your endometriosis until you lose 10% of your body weight. We covered mm-hmm. that, of course, because that's really important. Mm-hmm. We cover the trauma as well, because, you mm-hmm. know, in fact, each session we cover trauma more than anything mm-hmm. else, because mm-hmm. it's so traumatic. So I call it Take Your Power Back, because it's all about taking your power back in the consultation. So I run that that's course. Amazing. I also see clients one-to-one if people are just feeling like, help, I'm desperate. What yeah. do I do? Then yeah. they can, and usually it's just a one-off consultation with me where uh-huh. we just go, yeah, let's fix this all up for you. And by the end of it, we've got a plan in place for how they're going to get the care that they need. We've been that's successful. Amazing. I mean, I've been successful. You know, clients get back to me, which is great. They kind of come back to me and go, you'll never guess what.
Yeah.
But it's tricky. I get how tricky it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And you do all of that work online. So if yeah. folks are, because I think the majority of our listeners are in the States.
Yeah.
But so you do. Yeah. You
oh,
do
yes. I in fact, I mean, I would say that 50% at least of my clients are not UK based. Yeah. I'm very familiar with the US medical system, with Canada, with Australia. Like, I've worked with people all around the world.
Right.
It's all done online. And anything you want to know about what I'm doing, you'll find all on my website, which is factdoctor.co.uk. So perfect. if you want to find me, obviously I'm on Instagram and stuff, but all the stuff that I can help you with is all on my website. And as I say, hopefully I will be bringing out an ebook very soon. I'm self-publishing, it's not be a fancy ebook, but yeah. About Wegovy, for people who are interested in learning a bit more about these weight loss injections, not just the injections themselves, but the history and the drama and the intrigue. And it's quite, I mean, you know, it makes for a good TV show, really, I think.
Yeah.
to be quite honest. So
yeah, who's going to play the doctor and what's his name,
Nadolski?
Yeah, who's going to play him?
Oh, have to just who play would, himself, who would we surely?
Cast? We'd pick Chris Pratt, because I really don't like Chris Pratt. I have issues with Chris Pratt, so he would be the only one that could play Dr. N.
Mm. Great. Perfect. That's amazing. Brilliant. Thank you so much, Esha. You're an absolute superstar, and we are so grateful for your time and your expertise and your passion for helping people around all this stuff. And I know our listeners are going to be really grateful. So thank you.
Thank you for having me again. You'll have to come. I'll have to make it a hat trick.
Yeah, you absolutely will. You absolutely will. Great. All right. Take care. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye.